of how they can strengthen one another in a greater cause. So I think this replicates, you know, whether you're doing protection of elections, whether you're doing justice, whether you're doing the things that I'm most interested in at present, which is the subversion of the Russian military machine within Russia. We're going to have to learn how to put all our assets together if we want to compete. We're not going to create vertical systems like the autocracies. We're not going to become like Russia or China. Yeah. Our strength is diversity, but making that diversity become more than the sum of its parts is the challenge. And it's the tricky part, but it's eminently doable. I mean, we just have to get over this. We're just not in 1993. You know, when I look at the way donors work, when I think about how they work, when I see about how they distribute money, when I think about how people who think about change work, I do worry that we are stuck in a model in Western Europe, in America, that is completely outdated. Ukrainians do this all the time. Ukrainians have learned how to build, you know, a tense but often very productive collaboration between tech, civil society, private sector, government. Moldovans do it. Hungarians just did it. That's where the future is. And if before there was this idea that Central Europe will learn from the West, it's now the other way around. It's now Central Europe that has to teach the West how to save itself. It may be too late, but we need to try.
Gosh, I'm flattered, honestly. Thank you, Peter. Well, I am becoming his great fan, in fact. Yeah, he says that we need to join our networks of good. And I found it also very sad to hear that some nations don't feel this, the joint network of good. They feel, in fact, abandoned by the EU. Some panelists were asked if they believe their nation or Europe or the world in general has gotten into the autocracy trap. Haron Kirčić says that people in Bosnia do feel insecure seeing EU being so slow and indecisive regarding the war against Ukraine. Just like Peter Pomerantsev said, the grainy EU is just not fit for the emergency state like war.
There is no such, the international community is a very vague term, almost non-existential. Now with the United States pulling out of Europe generally, the EU is lost. They have no common policy. They don't know where they're heading. They have no common approach to the Balkans at all, nor even to Ukraine. So our problem was that we placed too much trust in the international community, thinking that they will solve our problems without us taking the initiative to do the same thing. What I'm afraid now is that the country is in such a state that, you know, media literacy is at a very low level, not developed our cognitive resilience. We are being bombarded with disinformation on a daily basis. People are openly questioning our loyalty to the EU and NATO and saying, hey, you know what? Maybe Russia isn't that bad. You know, maybe we might want to have Putin as our friend instead of having him as our enemy. And I think this is a completely wrong approach, that we are falling for cheap Russian propaganda in the Balkan region because people are feeling insecure and seeing that Europe is not able to put its act together, beef up its military presence in the region, beef up its presence of cybersecurity specialists, which will curb the dissemination of disinformation, protect our critical infrastructure, which is completely unprotected. The guys in the Baltics have done a fantastic job, but this is a different story. This is a case example of a very smooth transition from communism to the EU and NATO within.
Haron Kirčić is a Bosnian journalist, analyst, and executive producer in Al Jazeera Balkans. He was, before the media left the region. He specializes in geopolitics, foreign influence, and security dynamics in Western Balkans. Nino Rokabidze from Tbilisi, Sakartvelo, also known Georgia, tells that their society is trapped in autocracy now, but she believes they can get out of it, again, with the help of other countries.
My country right now is trapped in autocracy. However, many of my colleagues, they still are in Georgia. They continue their work under unprecedented for Georgian history crackdown. Zia Maglobeli, who is prominent Georgian journalist and publisher, she has spent already 16 months in prison for absurd charges. And this is the first case in independent Georgian history during these last three decades that we have women journalists as a political prisoner. Georgia now has more political prisoners per capita than Russia. So the crackdown on civil society and media was really dramatic. And it's continued, it's systematic during this last 6 years. Just during this last 1.5 year, Georgian government introduced more than 50 new laws mainly restricting freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of peaceful protest on the street. The situation is dramatic, but I still have strong belief that yes, it's possible to get out of this trap and go back on the track of democracy. However, I don't think that this is a solo project just for Georgia or just for one society. I really believe that democracy is a group project, and just Georgian society will not be able to find the way out of this very classical, very mature kleptocratic state capture in hands of one oligarch, which is using all his money, which is also not in Georgia, but everywhere in the free world, which actually is supporting Georgian democracy in the rhetoric. But Georgian society does not have a feeling that it is the end and we belong in this autocratic regime. Vice versa, this is perceived as a very temporary kind of backsliding, and we will get back on the track of democracy and our European aspirations sooner than later.
Nino Rukavica is a journalist, media manager, civic activist, used to be the country's director for IRX Georgia before the organization left the country. It's a USA organization helping build democracy and institutions in the USA and across the world. Democracy in one country is in the interest of all other democratic countries because autocracy spreads like virus. You just need to stop resisting and fighting back. That reminds me of an old proverb, for the evil to prevail, it's enough for the good to do nothing. How do autocrats create those traps? One way is mimicking the democratic institutions, pro-governmental fact-checking in Sakartvelo, elections for one party like in Soviet Union, or one president in Russia now. They don't say we want to consolidate the power. They pretend to be similar to Western democracy. They also use bureaucracy to make the laws fit their evil intentions. First, they say that this is part of another country on the paper, or like part of Germany, Russia, China, and then they come to liberate it, killing the locals. Perhaps you could remember how it was during the Nazi times, or you could try to think what AfD is trying to do exactly, or you could think of the examples from other countries. Igor Blazevich works with activists from Myanmar, and he also says that Western support there is very much needed.
Coming to the Myanmar, the profound problem there is that in today's world, autocracies help autocracies. They are very quick, very assertive, and very unapologetic about that. And autocracies help other autocracies to wage the war and repressions against the people of their own countries. And democracies, we put ourselves in a self-restrained mode, in which we are not just self-restrained not to help others who are fighting for the freedom and democracies around the world, but we are also self-restrained to, in a large extent, to defend ourselves. And that is creating the disbalance which I'm usually describing, that in Myanmar is a good example. In this moment, brutal military junta is actively assisted by the Russia and the China to wage the genocidal war against the people of the country. And we, as a democracies, have now abandoned any assistance there. But until recently, we are helping them a little bit to document the war crimes. And in this struggle in which we are, we cannot win or we cannot prevail if one side is investing in a war, huge resources, and we are investing in documenting crimes. With the documenting crimes are very important, but we need other investment.
Igor Blazevich has been long working with the people in war zones. He's the director of the Human Rights and Democracy Department and People in Need Foundation. He supports activists from Myanmar and stresses again that democracy is not one country's project. In the end of the panel on the topic of autocracy trap, I asked whether Russia can ever become a democratic country. I mean, Germany and Italy did make it somehow. Brazil made it. They also used to have military dictatorship during the Cold War times. But about Russia, I'm quite skeptical, honestly, because from what I know, they've never experienced real democracy there. The current opposition is very much imperialistic. They carry basically the same idea, but just with pretty European faces. I was still curious to hear what speakers have to say to it.
The problem of Russia is that there is no agency anywhere but with one person, and that's it. So it has to cease being an empire. It has to cease being the colonizer. It has to actually think about people like people. And then, yes, but then probably it will not be Russia any longer. So giving honest answer, yes, but no.
I think about that in two different ways. One is Germany has been Nazi Germany and became, let's say, something else. I do think it's possible. At the same time, when I'm thinking about kind of Russia, I compare it with Serbia. What will be good to break the vertical of the concentrated authoritarian power, which is dangerous for all its neighbors and for the rest of the world? And for the time being, that will be good enough. For us in the Balkans, let's say, it has been good enough when Serbia stopped to kill us. Still doesn't mean, let's say, that the Serbia became perfect democratic country, but it became the society in which there is internal competition between those who are fascists and who didn't disappear, those who are liberal democrats, and they are there as well, and the pro-Europeans, and then different groups of the people in between. So I think Russia, if we come in a situation in which there is no concentration of the power, which is aggressive to the rest of the world, and they are in an internal kind of the competition between themselves for the time being, that will be good enough.
I just want to say, just as a remark, that we do not have enough people to occupy Russia to fix it. And so the Second World War scenario is out of reach, so they will have to do the homework themselves.
You heard answers of Ivan and Igor in the end, but the audience, of course, laughed. I also cannot but laugh. We cannot occupy the whole Russia. But yeah, the short answer of the speakers is yes. But if they do something about it, if they do something for it, which I don't really see currently happening in Russia, I still believe in theory it is possible after the empire falls, but probably it will not be indeed Russia any longer. And I don't know, perhaps you listeners, probably we will not live up to seeing that. I really hope, I don't lose hope, that the Russian empire will finally fall. But yeah, I don't know, the Ukrainian drones are doing their work. We just need to keep fighting. We just need to buy more birds. We call them birds. For the empire to fall, we need the democratic countries to recognize it as an empire, as a prison of peoples. Then support more actively the independence movement. This is what if you're pacifist and you're against weapons and everything, this is what we have to do. This is what we have to push for. Recognizing Russia as an empire, as prison of people. And then really supporting the independence movement. It is there. It is there. It's quite weak. It badly needs our support, the support of the free world. Because it's good. It's not good just for this country. It's good for all of us. It's going to be good for all of us if we have made democratic, small democratic countries that have badly working, but some democracy. Or do we have a huge Russia that lives only from waging wars? And we need to work on it together. We need to bring about the fall of the empire. And then there is Linné Andersen, being a Danish futurist. She thinks how we can prevent the autocracies from appearing to begin with, from people to falling for its trap. Her answer is philosophy of Nordic Bildung.
You have both your emotions and the expectations of others inside you, and that's where you need to choose from time to time. Do I do what everybody else expects, or do I do what my emotions tells me? And that is when you're a free person. That is when you have moral and ethical choice and you can make up your own mind. So he actually connects the Bildung thing, basically psychological development, with political freedom. And that is where we are in the world today. And we see all these autocracies of either emotional people or people who do what everybody else does and who cannot speak up and who cannot fight for political freedom. So in order for us to have these free people and in order for us to have a free society and an open society, we need to educate in such ways that people are socialized into becoming team players. But then we need to bring ourselves into the next phase where we are like, yeah, but sometimes the majority is wrong. Sometimes I need to be able to speak up against them. I need to come up with a different viewpoint. And that's the tough one, because you may end up standing there alone and everybody thinks that you're like a traitor or an idiot or just too much. And sometimes you just have to learn to live with that and find the other people who are also too much. So that's a process. And one of the ways of doing that, and I think we would be addressing a lot of conspiracy theories in that project as well, if we could address this through art and through literature and through having these conversations around art and aesthetics and literature and moral values. If we read a novel and think about how would I have reacted in that situation, do I identify with the villain or do I identify with the good person? And why do I do that? Would I have chosen differently? That is when we build our moral muscle. So you don't necessarily have to go out into the world and make real mistakes. You can consider other people's mistakes in literature. But if we have conversations about it, if we educate for this, if we could read those great authors who struggle with moral issues and who struggle with injustice and war and the big existential challenges, if we could have those conversations with high school students and other young people and among ourselves, then we would figure out what does it mean to be human? What kind of human do I want to be? And that is where you can meet the conspiracy theories. That is when you can meet the AI. That is when you can meet the democratic challenges and you can meet the authoritarians and say, you know what? I think you're wrong. And sometimes that is just all you need to say. And maybe you need to walk away. At least then they lost one friend. Maybe they'll lose more. I think that in order to handle this complexity and the challenges that we're facing, we all need to develop a moral compass and ethics and our personal values, and we need to know them. So we need leadership in a different kind of way. I'm not just talking political leadership. I'm talking leadership at the workplace, in the family for that matter, among our friends, where we start talking about what is really important in life and why we make the choices that we make. It's a cultural shift.
Linnea Kjell Andersen uses the German word Bildung, the education, in its broader meaning, not just formal education, but also self-cultivation, formation of the human mind and cultural maturation. She believes that making the school children follow their curiosity and explore the world instead of studying for the exam, this can become a vaccine against autocracy. And just wanted to remind that the enemy of democracy is not only the names of dictators. The enemy is also different citizens who have lost their moral compass. And the society in they form, this is like the purest expression of political inertia. This was said by Olga Mironovich in her intro speech. And yeah, this is not just Putin's war, for that matter, because Putin is part of the society. He represents the society that is quiet and is complicit. Autocracy thrives on people's survival and fear. For the evil to prevail, it's enough for the good to do nothing. Another fun fact that I heard at the panel, at another panel, that democracy is a spectrum. Interesting enough that even Russia is still on the course, like on the verge, so to say. There is a quote for the politicians to think about, especially those in the beginning of their career, but also for us in the electorate. A politician thinks about the next election while the statesman thinks about the next generation. This is said by James Fremont Clark, US American philosopher in the past century. He was an American minister of theology and author of the 19th century. We have another song that we had much fun listening to after.
feel. Я в джинсы шами пил. Я пик with мамы статом. Я был на сцене забил. Стальной полит он шел, катал ушир гудиный брал. Я ненавидел поп, я слухал флика рок-н-ролл. Команд Батя, старайся не трусить, ты попил. Добей бродяга пятку и поедем. Файдей місто Чернобиль. Я там зустрів чувіху, їй 16 не було. Зовсім малолетка, але в ліжку я хахула. Я з нею все забув, забув про ширку і Дімедров. Але вона любила диско, а не рок-н-рол. Команд Батя, старайся не трусити попіл. Добій бродяга п'ятку і поїдем, файне місто Тернопіль.
Common Voices, a multilingual radio from migrants, about migrants, but not only for migrants. My name is Anastasia, and today I'm talking about the truth and reality being under attack. Based on the discussions of the Lviv Media Forum that took place in the beginning in May that I visited. In the beginning, you could hear the such speakers as Kolesyo Taka from Taiwan, Yevhen Hlibovitsky and Darina Pidhorna from Ukraine, Peter Pomerantsev from London, Solvita Denisa Lipnitsa from Latvia, Aida Tavakoli, originally from Iran, Harun Karcic from Bosnia, Igor Blazevich, here speaking from Myanmar, Nino Rokabidze from Sakartvelo, also known as Georgia, and Linnea Raquel Andersen from Denmark. In the first part, they discussed how to protect the truth and reality from the autocrats. The simple answer is that we just need to work together and recognize the complexity of the reality. In the second part, me and the speakers of the Lviv Media Forum were musing about the autocracy trap and how we could get out of the trap or not fall into the trap. And the simple answer, again, we need to work together because democracy is not one society project. Yeah, I know it's easier said than done working together. I know it from my own activist experience. It's very hard to work together. There are conflicts emerging. but we still need to keep doing it. We need to keep talking. And in this part, I want to explore the question of the role of media in protecting the truth, democracy, and building the society as the whole. And to begin with, the public media needs protection. The first thing that autocrats coming to power do is limiting freedom of speech and trying to close public media, of course, or limit it or censor it. Then they try to discredit it or ban it or both. As you might know, the AfD has proclaimed Korax as its enemy. They want to shut down us altogether. Of course, Korax is very uncomfortable for their existence. As we say it in Ukrainian, we are like the bone in the throat. Radio Korax is so much more than just public broadcaster. We host events. We do live public shows. Korax is the only platform where we migrant voices can be regularly heard. And this is one of the few places in the city and probably in the whole country, maybe also in the EU, where we migrants are welcome among Germans. Like, I really feel myself welcome here. This is where we can share our culture, our worldview, but also get political. So please support us by becoming our funding friend. The details will be in the show description on our website. Maria Frey from Ukrainian public media Suspilne shares the struggles and the superpowers of Ukrainian state public media.
Right now, it looks like Ukrainian public media is a very successful media organization, but we are not safe. If you're independent, you have always some enemies, and they will find ways to come back, and they will try to influence on your everyday operational decisions on different levels. So you have to be always ready to protect that you build. There are never calm time for independent media. This is an everyday struggle and everyday fight. And this, with this word connected, the trust, I could imagine that in everyday editorial decisions of our journalists, this is something that's on the first place. They are thinking about this all the time. It could be exhausting, but this is how they make their decisions. And the other thing that is crucial, I think, for independent media is to not only develop independent journalists who could provide all their decisions independently, but also to provide independent management. So you have to think whether you can protect these people who produce piece of information every day or not. And the other thing I would say that helped us during the full-scale invasion, and we are very connected to civil society organization in Ukraine. This is our biggest force for change. They are actually our biggest supporters with everything. They managed to give us all that we needed during the very beginning of full-scale invasion, and they still support us. And this invisible force is very powerful as well. And this is international support that we have. When something connected to some potential editorial influences, we have very strong people outside Ukraine from different countries, and they push our governments to do everything according to law. The biggest strength of Suspilne, this is a network of local journalists that we have, people who work in the field and who provide information directly from the communities to communities. When you do not have something like this, when you establish only national public media, it means that you will not be able to stay connected with real people. So our structure is totally different from other European Broadcasting Union medias because we have our teams across the country. And it was very difficult to work together as a united body, as a united structure, but it became a super strength.
Maria Frey is a senior executive at Ukrainian public media Suspilne. Interesting that Suspilne's superpower is the network of regional teams and that it's apparently the unique case for Ukraine. Only they provide trustworthy regional news that I like to use sometimes as the source when making news at Korax. Ukrainian news, I mean. And my favorite ones are super cute about rescued endangered animal species from the front lines and sheltered by vocal volunteers. So Spilne as a project is an embodiment of the best independent public media practices. They show that it is possible to work together in collaboration with civil society, a collaboration with foreign donors, and set standards for journalism. In Ukraine, unlike other European countries, there was a demand for a state media, public independent media. And Maria was involved in creating it, or rather reinventing this truly public media, Suspilne, which is called, translated as Commons, back in 2017. And her colleague Tamar Kintsurashvili from Sakartvelo, Georgia, explains why in a country like Ukraine and Georgia, so post-Soviet world, there is a demand for independent public media, and tells about the media situation in her home country.
Actually, media consumption in very polarized media environment depends largely on your political affiliation, and its habits are dependent on how you choose your information. We have very good legislation in place, but reality is different. And we have hope that we can use this legislation to reverse situation, but many things depend on the people. We have opposition representation in the Board of Trust. We have editorial topics that should be covered by public broadcaster informing public on EU and NATO integration. But when the ruling party, like you mentioned in Hungary, uses this platform to propagate on war fears and saying that you drag Georgia into the war to support Ukraine and open second front, this is a problem. There are some alternative movements, people dismissed from public broadcaster, launch their alternative programs. They have limited resources, of course, it's called Guardians of Public Broadcaster. And it's a small initiative, but gradually we hope to have alternative voices and alternative platforms balancing domination of ruling party. But the problem is also overall distrust in media. And the government invested a lot to create this distrust by creating parallel institution to independent charter of journalistic ethics, because in information disorder, when everybody lies, those who are controlling most resources, they are benefiting by manipulating public opinion, Russian style of modus operandi. Everybody lies, media ecosystem is very fragmented, and there is nobody to trust. The goal is to create distrust in all media outlets, not only opposition-affiliated entities.
Tamar Kintsurashvili is an executive director and co-founder of the Media Development Foundation in Sakartvelo, also known as Georgia. It's a leading Georgian civil society organization specializing in disinformation and media literacy. I believe that AfD is aiming to do the same with the German media. Just take them all under control, and those who won't comply, like free radios, like our Korax, just shut them down altogether. Chris Liu from Taiwan says that during the hard times, media has to be like the eye of a storm, providing the navigation and safety to the society.
It's almost impossible to counter every disinformation. It's almost impossible to do fact-check every disinformation, especially in the era of AI. It's much easier to produce disinformation than do fact-checking. So I would say that is the role when public media comes in, because there are so many disinformation. So public media provide a platform, a channel. When people don't know what to trust, at least they can go to the public media to look for reliable information. Just to give you one example, every time when Taiwan had our own election, we encounter very serious election interference from our strong neighbors. There are so many election fraud, so many disinformation related to election rigging. At that time, I believe that the Taiwanese audience will definitely go to public media to look for the reliable information. The last thing I need to add is about social media platform. The storm, the crisis in Taiwan is also a social media platform. Because more and more young people in Taiwan, they rely on influencer, rely on social media, especially the social media from China to receive their daily information. For example, cosmetic, tourism, everyday life. But the thing is, when there's clear political agenda behind the algorithm, which is the Chinese government try to control the algorithm and influence your perception, I would say that's a huge problem for media.
Chris Liu is the vice president of the International Radio Taiwan. He has a lot of experience in media management. He actually made the radio international and well-known. Although Chris admits that social media is a problem, and Peter Pomerantsev believes that because of that, media needs to really understand their audiences, understand their pains. Otherwise, propagandists will get to them.
Public service media have a role not just to talk to their audience, but who have a role to create a public, to create a citizenship that is engaging with one another in a democratic process. So the mission of public service media is different to the mission of a niche media that is already serving its audience. So the problem was, how do you do that in a time when young people are just drifting away to a different world, when you have polarization where parts of society are departing towards other environments? And the question is, can you have a coherent public? Can you have a coherent nation? Because media has always been the crucible where a nation is formed from the days of the newspaper. So that was the challenge. And how can public service media, whose job is to bring in completely different bits of society, how can they do that? Going back to the start of the 20th century, there was the same debate. There was very, very partisan media, tabloids, radio that was very, very partisan. And at the start of the 20th century, both in Britain and America, the idea of objectivity emerges. It's not a thing before then. Objectivity, impartiality, it becomes a way to raise some media above the debate and say, we are God. We have the voice of God. The BBC does this. The New York Times does this. We are above all the debates. Come here if you want something above what we would now call influencers. There was a lot of pamphleteers. And for a long time, this sort of godlike status was very powerful. And people would come to that cathedral to listen to that truth. And there you had all the standards about impartiality and so on. Now that has collapsed. Less and less people associate position of objectivity with absolute truth. And now we're in a different world where even somebody like the BBC has to think about, how do we engage very different audiences with an understanding of the millions of choices they have online, with the ease with which we can lose them? How do we find a way of talking to them and bring them back to a greater discussion? And I think what we're seeing is a turn towards understanding audiences better. At the end of the day, we're kind of in a race. Will the propagandists get to them? I mean, influencers is just a medium, it's just a tool, but are the people who are going to manipulate their emotions in order to spread lies and hate going to get to them? Or are we going to find a way to talk to them instead? I think it comes down to thinking not just about information, as in like the truth, but you have to start thinking about the cognitive dimension. What are the psychological vulnerabilities that are being engaged with? And what would be their alternative? Increasingly, I think the media whose job it is to create a public have to start thinking about, how do we understand those vulnerabilities? But instead of exploiting them, how do we encourage a discussion about them and bring them into public speech? So I'll give you an example from my Britain. For decades, public service media failed to talk to people in deindustrialized bits of Britain. We didn't bring out everything that they disliked about the changes in Britain. And because we didn't do it, the propagandists could walk in, win Brexit. That meant the media were not doing their job of making every bit of society part of a public discussion. And the result is 12 years of economic stagnation, the loss of our global standing, the rise to power of pro-Russian forces in our country, and probably within the next few years, the end of Great Britain as a coherent state.
Less and less the position of objectivity is associated with the absolute truth. Interesting, right? This is why Evhen Lyubovetsky believes that media needs to go beyond simply telling what's happened, but explain what it means to the audience.
I think media are the nervous system of society. Media are responsible for bringing the pains together. But that also means that the signals have to be interpreted. And I think media fail in quality of interpretation. When we see aggression in Ukraine among people, most cases, this will not be the malevolent action, but this will be a sign of pain. If people are crying, why are they crying? If someone hurts, how does it hurt? In some cases, this is sorrow, but in some cases, this is educational process. So we actually have to learn to interpret. That calls for mature journalists who actually can relate to the life experience. This calls for specific social letters that would actually bring more intelligent and more sophisticated people into the profession. So we actually have to understand where media and why media are important, and then give them the necessary protection so they can exist, including from their owners. It's a matter of understanding the task at hand. Most European countries have public broadcasters that in their missions state that they are to inform, entertain, and educate. Well, this is too little. The Ukrainian mission of the public broadcaster says protect freedoms in Ukraine. This is a much broader understanding of where the public broadcaster has to go. And the question that every journalist can ask himself or herself is, am I protecting the freedoms? Or am I just bringing showbiz? And that's exactly the question of how we as a society learn to be the educated, the sophisticated consumer of the media. Because at this point, the more I look into the markets and is where bias is okay now, as long as it's balanced, good reporting no longer emphasizes the importance of truth. Truth is relative. We basically are in a search of comfort where we should be in a search of reality.
Common reality.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because if I am comfortable, but all the people around me are miserable, this is not a sustainable comfort. It will come and bite us. And we're building a society where people are incredibly automized, where they are segregated from each other through their social media accounts and the way how they interact. And building solidarity in such a system is difficult. So we actually really need media to protect this ability to communicate. Otherwise, democracy can be doomed.
When we see the aggression, this is not only a malevolent action, but a sign of pain in the society, Evhen says. It makes me think of the recent event in Germany, a driver crashing into CSD demo. What kind of pain could that be? Why do people feel threatened by queers in any way? I think this person is just an executioner. Maybe he had also a psychiatric disease. Then this is the fault of the system that let him loose and doesn't treat him. But this is not the first case like that, and I believe not the last, of a man driving into a festive crowd and of a migrant origin, what I find even more suspicious. I believe they have to be treated like a string of cases that is probably being pulled by someone else. Perhaps a foreign state, perhaps Russia or China, who knows. A German journalist shared that in Germany there is a growing distrust to public media. And to that, Maria Frey said that, the role of journalists is not simply to give microphone to everyone, what Evhen talked about, to make showbiz, but to explain that what that voice means. I also asked another visitor of the conference, his name is Gigi, and he will better introduce himself, his opinion on what we do when the truth becomes irrelevant.
Hi, I'm Gigi. I'm here from Maine in the United States. I build collaborations between journalists. I'm an audio producer, a radio producer. I work with investigative journalists. I'm a subsistence farmer of information and conversation. The wider dissolution of civic society around the world. For me, Ukrainians are fighting on the front lines of a global war against curiosity. we too often get caught up in political discourse. And we talk about parties, we talk about false binaries. There is no direct conflict. Direct conflict as a story is efficient. So our cynicism means that we pretend there are two simple sides and you have to choose one. And what that does is that it simplifies and allows people to create unequal societies, build massive amounts of wealth at the expense of things that are inefficient, like art and creativity and community. And so if we frame this less as a political issue and more as people trying to end curiosity, you know what harms autocrats and oligarchs is curiosity and inquiry. The war is on people like you and me, Anastasia, because we are curious. And if we want to have efficient growth for a few people, we need people to be less curious. As a journalist, my job is never really about a static, clear truth. Journalism is about taking one question and creating more questions from that question. And so as truth is for me and for journalists who are helping make sense of the world, I believe truth can be treated as a destination, but it is the journey. So it's the pursuit of truth. We know there is actually, even with things that are quote unquote factual, there is scientists see that some facts will no longer be facts in 7 years or 10 years, depending on the discipline. The world is highly fluid now. What is truthful and what is the pursuit of truth is more important for me in some ways. So kindness is truth, is a truth of sorts. How I treat you, there's you, there's me, and there's what is our relationship with each other. Have we created an honest relationship? Can we sit in disagreement and still stand together? And that requires things like empathy and kindness, which we talk about as softness, and they're actually strengths. The things that are cowardly are violence and simplifying and hurting. So when I say there's not a static truth, there are lies. There's a very important rule of lies, which is that there's never just one lie. If you don't take a lie and say, that's a lie, you will then have two lies. Until you stop and name something as a lie, the lies keep growing. I think there is a responsibility we have, which is, how did you come to this conclusion? Why are you upset that I've pointed this out to you? And it's hard, especially as a journalist, because we feel like we need to debate it. And we don't need to debate it. We need to reveal to somebody why you believe a certain thing, and you can check your math. And the simple thing that I try to do with people is, that is so interesting. How did you come to that conclusion? If they argue with me, let's end it where we started, right? This is why it's a war on curiosity. And it's a war that we're all participating in if, when we have an opportunity to think, why is that person struggling? Instead, we say, well, that person's struggling. They must have done something wrong. And we construct a narrative about why they're the bad guys, as opposed to, how did they get there? And so empathy requires us to say, how did this happen?
The war on curiosity. The dictators, autocrats, they hate curious people. I believe I will not be able to survive. I would not survive a day in such reality. I'm just too curious person, as he said. And that's why, indeed, we need to keep asking questions. Gigi also talks about the empathy, Ida said, that we need to show empathy to our conversation partner and to ask questions. How did you come to this conclusion? Why? This is also what Gilte Sahebi, the Aida's colleague, Iranian colleague, but in Germany, the author of the book that I mentioned, she also says that we just need to ask questions and instead of just jumping into arguments. Honestly, I still need to learn that. Yeah, thank you for listening. So today we talked a lot about the reality, the truth. Is it being attacked? By whom? How can we protect it? And so far, the best thing that was said is that we need to learn to work together. As hard as it is, as painful as it sometimes is, we need to support each other towards the democracy, for the freedom. It is painfully hard. I know it myself. Sometimes you just want to walk away and never come back to that person and never talk to them, forget about their existence. But this is exactly what the authoritarian regimes want us to do, to just fight with each other and quarrel, and then in the end do nothing, achieve nothing. And the democracy is not just one country's, it's not just one society's project. This is also was an insight that indeed, like, it's very logical that we all need to fight for it. We all need to fight for the democracy, for the freedom. Because if Ukraine falls, which I hope not, but the chances are still, or okay, the Georgia, the Sakartvelo, if they fall, if Russia occupies even more territory, if Russia occupies even more territory in Ukraine and controls it, and they change the whole reality, they change the perception of the reality when they occupy the territory. They bring their books, they burn Ukrainian books, they say, okay, from now on, you're Russians. Forget about being Ukrainians. So we need to fight for this common reality. We need to share the reality. This is also something that I used to believe, that there is like one objective reality, one objective truth. But after the conference, especially during the preparation for this radio show, I realized that no, indeed, we see the piece of reality. It's just a piece. You know, like very famous story that blind people were walked to an elephant and they were touching different parts of it. Then they were asked to describe what they see and what the elephant looks like. So one touched the ear and said, oh, like this is something like flat, big. And then the other touched the leg. Oh, it's some wide, you can like hug it. So they were touching different parts. But they didn't know they were touching the elephant, and they haven't really shared the reality. So this is our task also. What did you see? How did you see? How do you see it? How did you come to this conclusion? Why do you believe that this is a threat to you? The queers are threatening you. Why do you believe that the more conservative people are threatening? Why do you believe they are evil? So we need to ask us questions. We need to ask our conversation partners. I heard it many times before also, and now the speakers repeated that building relationship, building trust, and supporting your local media. Please support Korax too. And thank you for being with us today. Thank you for listening to me. My name is Anastasia. I am an editor by Common Voices Radio, from migrants, by migrants, but not only for migrants. And here's the last song for you that was not really played at the after party, but it's a cover of another old Schlager song that is originally written by a man and covered by a woman, her Carpathian dialect. Осінь за листопадила, у душі задушило, я кохання не зрадила. Я його загубила, те, що серцем ти вимріяв, не могла зберігати. Журавлиному вирію віддала на крилята, а ти поклав своє кохання на вінтар, і його благословив небесний цар. А я любов твою розбила, мов кришталь, і за тим мені що сталося не жаль. А ти поклав своє кохання на вівтар, і його благословив небесний цар. А я любов твою розбила, мов кришталь, і за тим мені що сталося не жаль. Були ночі вінчальними, щастя кружляла, та з гіркими печалями нас журба повінчала. Не Всевишнього волею, а моїм небажанням, не зустрілися з долею, розминулись коханням. А ти поклав своє кохання на вінтар, і його благословив небесний цар. А я любов твою розбила, мов кришталь, і за тим мені що сталося не жаль. А ти поклав своє кохання на вівтар, і його благословив небесний цар. А я любов твою розбила.
розпила мов кришталь. І за тим мені, що сталося, не жаль. Поклав своє кохання на вітар і його благословив небесний цар. А я любов твою розбила мокрий шталь, і за тим мені, що сталося, не жаль. А ти поклав своє кохання на вітар і його благословив небесний цар. А я любов твою розбила мокрий шталь, і за тим мені, що сталося, не жаль.
Салам алейкум.
Бужбаш.
Привіт. Приходь до нас.
Common Voices.
I love the EU, the way you love granny who makes you a nice soup sometimes. But like, I mean, it can't get down the political stairs without like 10 people holding it. We can bring it out for a wedding. It has a lot of money, like that granny, so it's useful. But in terms of political will, in terms of a war, it's not the right partner. Because we're still operating as if this is some textbook mid-1990s scenario where we will let 1,000 flowers bloom, plant little seeds here, a little bit in academia, a little bit in media, a little bit in activism, and let it all bloom. We are facing an adversary, illiberal forces throughout the world, who approach the information environment like a war. So they're fighting while we are still living in a kind of idea of perpetual peace.
A voter is immature, a voter is a teenager, and a voter wants quick, simple solutions. And America needs complicated, long solutions to protect its prosperity and security. How to operate if you are a candidate for American presidency, asked George Friedman. And because if you offer to voters long, complicated solutions, you will never be elected. If you offer quick, simple solutions, you will be elected, but this is a populism. So what to do? His answer was a rather paradox. He said a candidate to American presidency must deceive American voters, promising simple, quick solutions of complicated problems, and then, being a president-elect, introduce complicated, long solutions for American prosperity and security.
It's not about us giving all those young people what the right answer is and what it means to be Danish. It's our task to let them find out what it means to be Danish. So we're going to give them Danish history, Danish literature, Bible stories, European history, Nordic history, different authors, and then we're going to let them explore it and discuss it. And we're going to give them something they didn't know is out there. And I think what we do today is we focus so much on the result instead of the input, instead of the students and what we would like to share with them in order to challenge them and excite them and give them something they've never heard about before. And we're worried that they may develop an opinion we don't like, or that they may choose another kind of education that they're supposed to choose, because we want them to join the workforce in a productive way. And that is how you develop informed, mature, conscientious voters who do not expect the politicians to just sell them the simple answers. And it's tough. And it's unpleasant. And good education sometimes makes you feel horrible, not because the teacher thinks you're stupid, but because it goes against your moral values or something your parents or somebody you look up to has convinced you about. Suddenly you realize that your dad was wrong. And he's not the strongest guy in the world anyway. That's a horrible moment, but that's part of education.
І хотів вас, пане Андрію, запитатися, от росіяни справді десь вирощують в якихось біолабораторіях цих корисних ідіотів, чи вони просто мають такий супровий підхід до того, щоб знаходити людей з якимись травмами, харизмою і використовувати їх на свою користь?
Все ж таки біолабораторії – це наша преференція. Залиште, будь ласка, їх українцям, не будемо віддавати росіянам. Це вже такий бренд певний.
There were a flame of discussions whether culture is out of politics or could not be out of politics and so on. But so many people around the world are speaking about great Russian culture and so on, but culture is not the art. Culture is not about just books and cultures and films and music. Culture is about